For dialect this week, we have two lectures, one left-wing, the other right-wing. And we start by going back to 2006, and we hear first Tony Benn, former Bristol Labour MP, now retired. And after that, we'll hear from Brian Gerrish, former naval officer, first from the left and then from the right. So we start with Tony Benn from 2006.
Well, thank you very much. I am a bit embarrassed because I've done lots of memorial lectures, Keir Hardie and Aaron Bev, and I feel I should begin with a tribute to Tony Benn. Older people may remember him with his pipe and his funny gestures. But anyway, very nice of you to ask me, and I am extremely proud to come. I am, as you know, a lifelong member of the NUJ. My connection with Bristol is something I'm immensely proud of. They made me a freeman of the city. When they wrote to me, I said, can I graze my cattle on your common land? And they said, we don't have any common land. And I said, that's very convenient, because I don't have any cattle. But Bristol was my university for 33 years, hours and hours every week. People came and told me their problems, and I learned from them. And very shrewd they were. One example, I've kept this letter. I haven't kept every letter from Bristol. But at the time of the space race between the Soviet Union and the United States, the Soviet Union put a great big space vehicle on the moon, an enormous thing with caterpillar tracks. And I had a letter from a constituent in Bristol saying, dear Tony, I see the Russians have put a space vehicle on the moon. Is there any chance of a better bus service in Bristol? Actually, that's the key question. What do you use it for? And then, of course, when I had a bit of problem with the House of Lords, I was a disqualified, described as unfit and unable to be a member, and I was re-elected with the biggest majority ever. And I don't believe in the hereditary system. A very simple reason: if I went to the dentist, and just as he started drilling, he said, I'm not a dentist myself, but my father was a very good dentist, I don't think I would know what to do. But anyway, my life has been in media and politics, and the thing about the subject we're discussing is it's information is the most powerful weapon in the world, and always has been. Of course, if you have a gun and can control everybody else, the information they get is that if you disobey the leader, you'll be shot. That's information. Fear is information and is used crudely now to control people. The church was a media. There was a time when you had to go to church. And then the control of what came out of religion. You see, in 1401, just before I was elected to the House of Commons, they passed the Heresy Act, under which it was a criminal offence for any person who wasn't a priest to read the Bible, because they didn't want the news of the Bible to get into the wrong hands. And you were burned at the stake as a heretic if you read the Bible. The Church of England was nationalised. It's our oldest nationalised industry because it was so powerful. Then you had Caxton, you had Milton, his campaign for press freedom. The Royal Mail, I was Postmaster General once, and I wondered why Charles II had nationalised the post office. I thought, was he an early unrecognised socialist? The reason he did it was he wanted to open everybody's letters. And the only way he could do it was having the Royal Mail. So the Royal Mail was the birth of MI5. Then, of course, we had Rowland Hill, who was a 19th century precursor of the internet. People could get information for the first time. Then you had the BBC. Now, that was nationalised, too, because it was too powerful to leave in private hands. And now, of course, with Murdoch and the tabloids, you have it concentrated in many other ways. But influence is power, and we saw in the American elections one example of that. Now, having talked about the information we need, they don't want us to know anything, but they want to know all about us. They bug our phones, ID card, database, so that everything about us is known to them and can be used for what purposes they like. So that is the background, and the power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. And you see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days, it was land and factories. But now, it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have. And the use of religion. Now, this appalling idea, Bush said that God wanted him to go into Iraq. I didn't know God had such a hands-on view of current affairs. Then Osama bin Laden says, if you don't believe in the Quran and be executed. Then the Jews come up with a wonderful idea that when Moses went up Mount Sinai, he allocated Palestine to the Jews. I didn't know God was an estate agent, but apparently that was his function. And at every period in history, there's been a conventional wisdom you have to accept, whether it was the empire, a foreign enemy, the Cold War, everyone was a communist. Remember, we were told that if we didn't have NATO, the Red Army would arrive in Bristol and we'd all have to read Stalin. And the demonizing of people they don't like and the praising of people they do. And that is the basis of a great deal of power. Now, of course, the global media today has the capacity to present and explain the news, and it reflects the interests of those who run it. And this is most obvious to me. If you listen to a news bulletin, every day they give you the business news. I've never met Mr. Dow Jones, but my God, he must work hard because he's doing his averages every day. But they don't tell you relevant information. Why don't they tell us every hour how many people are unemployed? How many people are waiting for hip operation? How many people can't live on the pension? You can't write to your MP and say, I'm never voting for you again because I see the Dow Jones has fallen. He can't do a damn thing about it. And this is a way of persuading us to believe that what happens in Wall Street is the key to the whole thing. And it is, what it does, of course, is to exclude what it doesn't want us to know, which is statistics on poverty, accidents, demonstrations. And the media are very largely interested in violence. That's what they really like. I've got an old friend, Jack Jones. He's 93 now. He was the president of the Pensioners Confederation. I did a meeting with him up in Blackpool a couple of years ago. And, you know, there are 11 million pensioners and a couple of thousand of us walking. We can still walk. And I said to Jack at the beginning, I said, there won't be a word of this on the television unless you take this brick and throw it through McDonald's. And I said, if you do that, there will be a bishop on Newsnight discussing the rising tide of violence among old people, and they'll bloody well discuss the pension. He didn't throw the brick, and not a word of it on the news. And, you know, the big peace demonstrations, 3 million in London 3.5 years ago, the biggest demonstration in the history of this country. And all they did was to give a police estimate. I'm going to teach the police how to count one day, because the police always say it's a tiny thing, and then they show a Muslim with a beard shrieking, but they don't report any speech that's ever made at a public meeting, because in a way it challenges their monopoly of information. Then they interview each other all the time. Journalists interview other journalists about what other journalists have said about other journalists, and before you know where you are, you've got so far separated from what is really happening that it's very, very difficult to keep abreast of the news. And they set the agenda and decide who speaks, and that is of enormous importance. They won't let you, for example, look at the camera. You'll say, you mustn't look at the camera. You've got to look at the interviewer, so you become a puppet in his game. And if you look at the camera, it's much too powerful. Of course, all the major interviewers, all the major presenters look at the camera, but you're not allowed to. And they have a special, what I call the BBC health warning. Before Roy Jenkins, which he could say now in a major address to the nation, Lord Jenkins of Hillhead, or it was, in a wise message, said this, and then Tony Benn, an extreme left-wing nutter, said this, and once you've got the health warning established, then of course they don't listen to anybody. And I think one of the problems they have is they underestimate people's intelligence, because with the state education and the satellites and the internet, people are much, much better informed than the guys at the top. And when I say the media and the political people are very much the same, you know, they're one part of the same outfit. They think everybody would just want to watch Celebrity Big Brother or Love Island or whatever it's called. And they're absolutely wrong. I'll give you a couple of examples. I did a meeting in East London the other day on housing. And I got there early. And there was a very, very scruffy woman sitting next to me. She was early too, selling a Trotskyite magazine. And I said to her, what do you do when you're not doing this? Oh, she said, I'm a gynecological surgeon at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And I was at Paddington the other day, and the black guy clipping tickets recognized me, came over. I said, what do you do? Well, he said, I'm from the Congo. He said, I went to Moscow. and did a degree in journalism at the Lumumba University. I write for the Irish Times in Dublin. So I said, what are you doing clipping tickets? Oh, he said, I'm saving up money to go back to the Congo to start a new newspaper. Now, how do you actually cope with that if you believe that people are so stupid they only want it all laid on? And I think that is a very, very serious problem they have in dealing with us, and means that they don't actually, they're not able to communicate with us in the way they think they do. Now we come to the next question, which is the attitude of the political parties to the media. Because ever since all these, the Americans started it, this idea that if you employ people who are expert, they will enable you to get it across. And it's so different from the early party political broadcasts. I've got a terrible archivist. I've never thrown anything in my life away. And I've got a video of Ramsay MacDonald doing a party political broadcast, and he stood there with his hands on his lapels as if it was a public meeting and just addressed. It was totally ineffective. And then when Hugh Gates School was Chancellor, I was advising him, and he did the first television broadcast about the budget. And there was panic in the BBC. How do you describe the budget on television? So believe it or not, they built a great wall, which said it's the terms of trade, and then they had a ladder called productivity, and Gates School was to climb up the ladder and pick the apple of prosperity from the tree of growth. And this was all later. They didn't know how to deal with it. Just as it began, I heard one engineer say to the other, are you lighting for or against? Which tells you all you needed to know. And then you see when Nye Bevan did the first broadcast, I took him to Broadcasting House. And Nye is a passionate speaker, public speaker, but he'd never done that. And so he insisted on a stand mic, and he walked round it and addressed it like a public meeting. And of course, Clem Attlee was even worse, because Clem was so monosyllabic, it was impossible to get anything out of him. People said that conversation should be like a game of tennis, but with Attlee, it's like tossing biscuits to a dog. He's gobbled up the questions. And I did the first party political broadcast with Clem, and it was 15 minutes long, and we put 28 questions in, thinking that would cover. He polished them all off in about 11 minutes. And we were left with the rest of the broadcast. I didn't know what to do. And somebody, we'd just been defeated in the 51 election, and somebody thought of a really good question. But, Mr. Attlee, isn't it true that the balance of payments is worse now than when you were in office? Would you give him an opportunity to describe the merits of Labour policy? And all he said was, that may very well be so. And then he shut up again. So, you know, you need a bit of expertise. But the problem about the expertise the parties now have is it is very, very, very expensive. And that's why the Labour conference has been turned from a meeting where people talk and discuss and decide into a trade fair, because you go to a Labour conference now just full of trades of stands, and it's treated as if it was a sort of week-long ministerial broadcast. The BBC don't broadcast what other people say, it's only ministers. It's also a very interesting conference in the sense it's the only conference in the world where they search your bag when you arrive, and they do, not for bombs, but for political literature. Walter Wolfgang, and if you remember him, he went to the Labour conference last year, and he made the best speech at the conference. Jack Straw was speaking, and he said nonsense. That was all he said. And he was ushered out, interviewed under the Prevention of Terrorism Act, and he's now been elected to the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, so there must be some support for his view. But you see, the whole thing is on focus groups, spin doctors, rebuttals, and the way in which ministers try to control what appears in the media. And I've had journalists tell me that when they were appointed to work for whatever it was, The World at One or Newsnight, they would get a phone call from the Labour Party wishing them well. And then later, if they put an item high enough on the bulletin that the number 10 didn't like, they would get a warning. If you go on with that, we will not be able to give you the news stories that you really want. And it is absolute threat that goes on. And journalists are tremendously threatened on the quality of journalism. I come to that and I agree with it very, very strongly. But don't forget, they are themselves very, very tightly controlled by number 10. And of course, MPs are controlled too. because there's a computer at the Labour Party headquarters called Excalibur. And everything every MP, Labour MP, has ever said is on Excalibur. It's the only place where I got coverage for my meetings, because even if they weren't reported, they put it down. And then if somebody comes up to broadcast, they look on Excalibur and say, we better not have him on or her on, because her views on this are unacceptable. And we get MPs, well, I don't get it anymore, because, you know, I left Parliament because I wanted a bit more time for politics. But when I was a Member of Parliament, I used to get faxes every day telling me what to say. And I felt, well, I once made a speech saying, I feel like an Avon lady. When you knock at the door, you're told what to say. And I had a furious letter from the managing director of Avon, said, how dare you compare MPs with Avon ladies? But it is a fact that that's what they try to do. It is a control system, because they realize how powerful information is. And, of course, then we come to the secrecy that surrounds everything the government does. Do you remember Spycatcher? This man wrote a book. He'd been in MI5, and he said, we bugged and burgled our way around London, and everybody in Whitehall turned their back because they knew what's going on. So they banned Spycatcher. Wouldn't let it be broadcast. Wouldn't let it be published here. And I used to listen to Spycatcher being read on a radio in my attic as if I was in an occupied country. I remember hearing it being read from Norway or Sweden. And that was because they didn't want us to know. And then there was the other example of banning Gerry Adams on the grounds that if his voice was heard, it would increase terrorism. So what they did, the BBC, I give them full marks for that, they just got an actor who sounded just like Gerry Adams, and he used to read what Gerry Adams had said. And it was much more effective, rather better than Gerry Adams putting it across. And that's another reminder while we're at it, that, you know, all the people we arrested as terrorists in my life, we arrested Gandhi, I met him in 1931, we arrested Nehru, of course Mandela, Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya, who else? Kwame Nkrumah, who was toppled in Ghana, Teddy James, all the people we arrested as terrorists ended up having tea with the Queen as head of Commonwealth countries. And I say to the Americans when I see them, because I love America, I know it very well, my wife is American, I say, you know, when we had an empire, we were absolutely hated, but when we left, we got quite popular. Have you ever thought of that as a possibility? And it is. Then, of course, when the Soviet Union banned and blocked the BBC, that was considered an outrage, a denial of free speech. And then, in return, NATO bombed Al Jazeera in Belgrade. And you could see how powerful information is. And they saw the danger of it. And then, of course, there are all the press officers in Whitehall. And then they're the number 10 spokesman. I made a film a few years ago called New Labour in Focus. It was huge fun to make, because I went around with the camera and got things that had never been shown before. But what happens is this, just to let you know, every morning at 10 o'clock or wherever, all journalists come to number 10 and are told what the government is thinking. At 1 o'clock, they turn out outside number 10, and they tell us that we think the government's mind is moving in this direction. They've just been told it. Then in the afternoon, there's a press conference at the House of Commons, which is absolutely secret, and they're brought up to date, and then they tell us on the 9 o'clock news. And dare I say it, but the lobby correspondents are embedded correspondents, like the guys in Iraq. They go there, they meet the general, who says we're doing very well, so they come on the news at night with their satellite broadcast. You'd say, I can assure you that we're doing rather well in Iraq or whatever. And it is a way in which the co-option of the media by a government is very, very powerful. And then, of course, you have the press proprietors. I have dealt mainly with broadcasting because I'm an old BBC man, but they are very important as well. And the chairman of the BBC, of course, is appointed by the Prime Minister because it's nationalised, just as the Prime Minister appoints the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's interesting, isn't it? He could be a Muslim Prime Minister and he would still appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury, because we've got to stay true to our traditional values. And the first thing that Mr. Blair did when he became leader was go straight to Australia to see Murdoch. And Murdoch is the most powerful man in the world. He will be there after Bush is gone. He'll be there after Blair is gone. He's got newspapers and television in Australia and here in America. He's got satellite in China. And these are the people who really are powerful. And of course, they employ the journalists and control the journalists. Now, the next thing is the question of the new technology. I'm what they call a silver surfer. I have a laptop and I struggle. I can get my emails and send them, but when it goes wrong, which it does regularly, I ring up my grandchildren, they press a couple of buttons and it works. But it is a fact now that with the internet, you can get a great deal better coverage of the world than you would get from reading the newspapers. I don't know if anyone's heard of Information Clearinghouse, but I've had it for a very long time, and I get a summary of all the world news, just summarized every day. It takes me about 10 minutes to read it, and it covers everything. And it's very difficult to censor the internet. They would like to censor it, but it's very, very hard. And this is why the whole question, you see, of the censorship is so important, going back to Milton. Or do you remember Hansard was jailed for reporting what went on in the House of Commons? Every issue in the past is back on the agenda again when you come to the modern technology. And in Singapore, I think you can only get onto the internet via a government server. In China, Google have been told they can't operate there unless they censor it. In America, the Americans are trying to get Google to agree that every inquiry made by anyone on the internet is reported to the intelligence services. So if I'm a Muslim and I want to study chemistry, that will go to them and they'll say he must be a potential terrorist. And it is absolutely terrifying. But access by the public is now much easier. And when you think of even the mobile phone could be used during the miners' strike, the miners were pretty clever about that. What they used to do was, because I was an MP by then for Chesterfield, they would ring each other up and say, by the way, Bob, there's a big strike at such and such colliery on Friday, pass it on, will you? And of course, there wasn't a strike there. So when they got, they'd send someone on a bike and he'd see hundreds of police there who'd been bugging their phones, and actually they were going somewhere else. And so it is possible to use what you might call clever intelligence methods. But I think in the globalized resistance to the war, the internet had an enormous effect. These huge demonstrations that take place, and I did one in New York a couple of years ago, 100,000 people in New York against the war, and all these are organized on the net. Not everybody has the net, but all the people who organize demonstrations, they coordinate them, they bring people over, they notify other people, and it is an extremely powerful influence. And I think, although it could be used, you could have neo-fascists using it as well, it does provide people with an opportunity to hear a case. Because the real problem, if we're talking back about information and democracy, is the question of access for those who don't have financial resources. Now, we do accept, don't we, that education is funded by the state. That began when was the First Education Act in the latter part of the 19th century. That had to be done because you needed a few educated people to run modern industry, so they educated a few people. So that's recognized, that the state has a role in education. Then, of course, in elections, the only help that the government gives political parties gives them free party political broadcasts. In America, you have to pay millions to get your case on the air, but in Britain, you get the party political broadcast. Also, the government funds the distribution of election addresses. So every candidate is allowed to write his statement and the post office will deliver it free. I think that's a very, very good thing to do, because otherwise, the whole thing is commercially controlled. And I have a very old friend called Jack Gilligan, who was the Democratic governor of Ohio. And when I was last there, I had a chat with him. And he said, Tony, there will never be democracy in America while big business buys both political parties and expects a payoff whichever one wins. And that is happening. There's a bit of it here. You know, I don't know whether peerages have been sold, but if they haven't been, it's the first time for centuries they haven't been sold. And so it's you know, there is a hint of corruption. I won't say more than that. But the right to free speech doesn't mean a lot if you haven't got the right to be heard. You could go to Hyde Park Corner and say what you like, but of course it isn't reported. And I think the right to be heard is a basic political right, and it applies to journalists too. Journalists have the right to be themselves when they write, and not just tools of their employer. And the soundbite and the bullying, I don't think helps very much. I don't know about you, but if you go on the telly and they bully, all it does put you in a defensive mode, whereas the purpose of a decent interview should be to find out what the person you're interviewing wants to say. I got into terrible trouble when I interviewed Saddam Hussein because I didn't bully him enough. I didn't want to bully him. I wanted to ask him some questions. First of all, do you have weapons of mass destruction? He said, no. I didn't know whether to believe him or not, but he was telling the truth. I said, do you have links with Al-Qaeda? I knew he didn't, because Osama bin Laden hated Saddam because he was a secular dictator. And he said, no. And the purpose of the good interview is to bring out what people want to say, and you've got to have enough time. I was interviewed the other day by Al Jazeera, and I said, how long do you want? You know, I'm used to it, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I said, oh, 2 hours. And they took me through the whole Palestine story from the beginning and so on, and I said, what's the audience? Well, he said, it's about 70 million. He said, we're rebroadcasting it again tomorrow. Now, you know, that is a new form of communication. And I think the satellites, Al Jazeera has just started an English service. David Frost is doing it. I hope that doesn't weaken its impact. But, I mean, you know, you can hear points of view you can't hear any other way, because international viewpoints are the way in which we're going to make progress. And public meetings are, I say, completely ignored. I get asked occasionally by the BBC, we're doing a programme on the death of the public meeting. Would you do an interview? I said, I'd love to, because I've done 10 of them this month. And they don't report them. And they do, after all, this is a public meeting, isn't it? You can relax, because I'm not asking you to vote for me. But, I mean, it is a public meeting. And that's what, this is the way in which people exchange their experience. And Parliament is very, very poorly covered. Parliamentary questions aren't an awful lot of good now. I mean, in the old days, I put down a question to Winston Churchill when he was Prime Minister, could you explain Britain's nuclear relations with the United States? And he gave me the answer. Now we have all these loyal backbenchers who don't ask a question at all. They say, could I trouble my right honourable friend to remind the House of his latest triumph since last Wednesday? And somebody said, there's so many planted questions, it ought to be called gardener's question time. But actually, There really is no... members of Parliament are responsible for this too. Mind you, if they do ask difficult questions, then the BBC will issue a health warning. They're troublemakers and mavericks and all that. And that's the problem you have to face. But at least if you have proper historical sense, you realise that people who may be denounced at the time, if they say what they mean and mean what they say, may turn out to have been the first voices of sense, for example. I mean, can you imagine what Jeremy Paxman would do to a suffragette today? Here's a woman throwing bricks through the window, in prison, on hunger strike, just a publicity stunt, and now they got the vote. Now, wouldn't it be better to listen to them when they're saying difficult things? Or another example, Swampy. Remember Swampy? He was a great troublemaker. He was always going out, being arrested by a constable for something or another, but he was talking about the environment, and utterly ignored. And now everyone talks about Kyoto and climate change. So the media have a responsibility for exploring the range of opinions so as to get it across. And I also think, and this is the key to the whole thing, the rights of journalists. If you're not organised, you don't have much influence. So when I worked for the BBC, they didn't recognise the National Union of Journalists. There was the BBC Staff Association, a sweet company union, and trade union recognition, and a bit of industrial democracy. I believe most passionately, if you want to improve anything, talk to the people who do it. You know, we've got these awful management consultants. I don't hope none of you are here, and if so, you have to apologise. But there was a lovely story which illustrated that perfectly, and if you've heard it, forgive me, about the boat race that took place between the BBC and a Japanese crew. And as you can imagine, both sides practiced long and hard, and the Japanese won by a mile. So the BBC called in management consultants, what should we do? And they reported that the Japanese had 8 people rowing and 1 steering, and the BBC had 8 people steering and 1 rowing. So they recommended the BBC crew be completely restructured, with 3 assistant steering managers, 3 deputy steering managers, a director of steering services, of course, and the rower be given an incentive to row harder. And they had another race. This time they lost by 2 miles, so they laid off the rower for poor performance, obviously, and they sold the boat and used it for a higher-than-average pay award for the director of steering services. Now, wouldn't it be better to listen to the journalists and listen to the printers and the people who know what it's about? Journalists must be able to write freely, because their freedom, like a freedom of members of parliament, they don't always exercise it, but it should be there. And the moral responsibility of journalism is of enormous importance. I came back in a troop ship in the summer of 1945, and I heard the words of the Charter, the preamble of the Charter of the UN, and they're written in my heart. It said something very simple. It said, we the peoples of the United Nations, it didn't say we the coalition of the willing or we the free peoples or whatever, we the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge my generation, I'm 81, gave to the younger generation, and we tore it up when we went into Iraq. And UNESCO had a preamble in a way even simpler. It said, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. And that is what journalism should be able to do, to make it possible for people to see the simple, plain, stark truth that this generation is the first generation in human history that has the power to destroy the human race, kill one or two with a bow and arrow or a spear or a machine gun or a bomb. But with nuclear, chemical and biological weapons, it is possible to destroy the human race. But also, it's the first generation in human history that has the technology and the know-how and the money to solve the problems of the human race. A fraction of the cost of the war or the Trident, and everyone in Africa with AIDS would have had free drugs. Bush could have protected New Orleans from the Katrina. There could be a health service in America. And that's the choice. And so the information we get about that choice is crucial to our survival and integral to the role of the journalist. And that, I think, is what it is about. And if you say, how are we going to do it? Because some people are very pessimistic. I'll finish with a wonderful quotation from an old Chinese called Lao Tzu, who lived many years before the birth of Jesus. And he was asked about leadership. Now, you know, leadership, people get up and say, I've taken the tough decision. That's the way it's described. But what Lao Tzu said was this. He said, as to the best leaders, the people do not notice their existence. The next best they honor and praise, the next best they hate, the next best they fear. But, said Lao Tzu, when the best leader's work is done, the people say we did it ourselves. And I profoundly believe that. But if we're going to do it ourselves, we've got to know what's going on and be assisted to reach the right decision. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
That was Tony Benn in his 2006 Benn Lecture delivered at the Arnold Fini, inaugurating a series of Benn Lectures with Arnold Fini and the Bristol National Union of Journalists. Now over to the right-wing side, and Brian Gerrish talks about Common Purpose to me back in 2008. This is former Naval Officer Brian Gerrish.
My name is Brian Gerrish. I'm a former Naval Officer, and I've been talking about the so-called charity Common Purpose at AV2 today.
Tell us about the charity. Why do you raise this as an issue? What are your concerns?
Well, a number of us have been researching Common Purpose as a charity for about 5 years now, and what we are establishing is that it is politically involved, which a charity shouldn't be, and it is also overwhelmingly funded by public money, which tends to question its charitable purpose in that context as well.
So what evidence do you have that there is a political involvement with this particular charity?
Well, we have hundreds of documents relating to common purpose which show that during courses there is a clear movement to include politics, and particularly European politics, but we can show them having meetings with senior members of the European Commission or people who are completely pro-European, or indeed we can see them mixing with the higher levels of the Labour government.
But I mean, isn't this just a strategy that many charities are adopting because they can see that there may well be more influence to be gained in Europe than there is by, say, for example, lobbying the Westminster Parliament?
Well, I think the first thing we've got to look at is what we think a charity is, because the average member of the public would expect that a charity was a body actually doing good works for people or individuals. But if we look at the facts, we find that we've got over 170,000 charities registered in the UK with a total budget of over £44 billion. And the top 10 of those charities are consuming most of that money. And interestingly, the money is not coming from donations from the public. It is coming straight out of the taxpayers' pocket. So we can question, first of all, what the basis is, because they're not acting as a charity. But the second thing is that why are we suddenly using charities to assist in any form of political lobbying process?
Okay, so if you're saying that this is a political organisation, they surely don't say that themselves. How does Common Purpose actually present itself?
Common Purpose claims to be a leadership training organisation, which is training people to be future leaders of society, quote, future leaders of society.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, surely. I mean, if people are looking to the future, trying to make things better for the future, then they will want to be making sure that people, at least some people, are well equipped to lead the country in the future. Surely there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, this is the question of what it says on the tin and what it actually does. But what we need to look at is how the charity works. And the first thing it is that it's highly selective. So people are selected and accepted or rejected into Common Purpose by a screening process run by their advisory boards. The advisory boards being a committee, effectively, of senior Common Purpose people. So from the moment an individual goes near Common Purpose, they are going through an elitist selection procedure.
Well, they've got to have some sort of selection. They can't just have everybody, surely.
Well, if you say in the beginning you are a charity, then one would presume that they are going to be treating all individuals in a similar way. But
I mean, say, for example, you're in a disabled charity, you would only be targeting your work at disabled people, wouldn't you?
So if Common Purpose, under that logic, is targeting future leaders, it is being highly elitist in its selection procedure in the first place.
So how did a naval officer come to be engaging in this sort of campaign?
If I go back to about 2000, together with another ex-naval officer, we were trying to help the local community in Devonport. That's the dockyard area of Plymouth. And we were trying to help in particular the long-term unemployed younger people especially, and we came up with a project that was going to do basic skills training on the repair and build of wooden boats. Surprisingly, although the project met every criteria, which is to create jobs, to support the local community, to get skills base going back into the area and to help a deprived community, it was shut down. And it was shut down with threats, intimidation, bullying from people within the public sector. And when we started to look for reasons as to why such an attitude would occur, we found that inevitably you found Common Purpose people in the positions of power. And that then started what has now been a protracted investigation of Common Purpose, where we have discovered that this so-called charity now has thousands of people as its future leaders established in positions of power in cities across UK. So we have a quasi-secret organisation now steering political and social policy in a number of cities. Why would common purpose people be instrumental in helping to shut down our project? Because we are looking at the formation of a new society. That's what common purpose wants. But before you create the new society, you actually have to close down the old society.
So what evidence do you have that the common purpose really was behind the closure? I mean, that sounds to me like it could be just speculation.
You may think it's speculation. However, for us that were on the receiving end, every time we had somebody who was being particularly unpleasant, unhelpful, or applying a bullying attitude, it was a remarkable coincidence that they were common purpose.
But you say this is a secret charity or secretive charity. What evidence do you have that it's actually secretive? You can see there's a common purpose website, and they're not hiding that they exist, are they?
Well, I actually said it was quasi-secret because it does have an open website. But what is secret is the fact that, one, when meetings of common purpose people are held, they're held behind closed doors under Chatham House rules, which means that although information revealed can be used, you don't say who was at the meeting or who gave a particular piece of information. The other thing is that people who are common purpose trained do not declare themselves within their parent organisation. And we have documentation which clearly shows people within different organisations conspiring to pass information to the advantage of common purpose and indeed to the detriment of their own organisation.
Well, if we've got public servants making decisions around a table, whether it be local authorities, police or whoever, obviously if they do have an interest, they have to declare that and step out of the meeting. Otherwise, then we're talking about possible criminal offences.
Well, there's a big difference between what procedures should be taking place, and you're quite correct in what you've described. But I can assure you that although council officers should declare that they're common purpose trained, they overwhelmingly don't declare. Indeed, we now have a large amount of documentary evidence which is showing that even when you ask who is actually common purpose trained within the council will refuse to tell you. So whereas a Freemason would be required to declare that interest, common purpose as a charity doesn't declare that interest. And I'll just add to that is that when common purpose encourages and holds closed door meetings where you can have, for example, a council official who is responsible for the administration of budgets, the award of funding, together with local developers who would love to have that funding, together with local police officers and perhaps somebody from the local university, and the public is not told what actually happened in that room, I believe that there is, one, a large element of doubt in the public's mind as to what is actually happening, but two, we are seeing secrecy in the operations of common purpose.
What about this common purpose training? How does one get recruited to do the training, and what is the training itself like?
You have to be selected, so the advisory boards in each city are described as the eyes and ears of common purpose, and we presume by that they're on the lookout for new prospective graduates, as they're called. Once somebody's name has been put forward, they're added to a list, and at a particular point in time the advisory boards will meet and decide which of the candidates are the most suitable. Now, this is a very interesting process because we know that quite a lot of personal information is being recorded on people, such as their ambitions, what they want to do professionally, what their likes and dislikes are, what their fears are. So a clear profile, psychological profile of the person is collected. And we know and can show that common purpose is overwhelmingly interested in people of positions of power and influence within the public sector. So if you control people and budgets within your city council, you would be a prime target. And once the selections have been made, those names are then put forward for the common purpose training. We can even show that the majority of those people put forward are paying maximum rate, and if you are in a public body, it's the taxpayer who's paying. And on occasions, a few other people, others, are included to pad the numbers out, and some of those people may pay a very reduced rate as a bursary. But I believe that is a cynical attempt to make common purposes selection process appear non-elitist.
If they're making profiles on people, psychological profiles, what's the problem with that? Many organisations do that these days.
Well, many organisations do this these days. However, we need to ask a lot more questions as to why, because if you collect information on somebody's psychological profile, that information by a skilled operator can be used to actually manipulate that person's actions and views in the future.
How is that? Give us an example of how you think that might be used.
Well, you could pick up from somebody's profile, for example, that they don't enjoy speaking in front of other people, and therefore, if you have them in a group, you can put that person under pressure by forcing them out in front of their colleagues. For some people, that can put them under sufficient pressure that you can then actually mould what information they take in and what they will do for you.
So have you had actually any hard and fast information about who is and who isn't part of this common purpose organisation, who is and who hasn't gone through this common purpose graduate course?
Well, at the moment, Common Purpose declares that it's trained over 25,000 people in the UK. We certainly hold several thousand names, which have been collected over a number of years, and we can see from those names that there is a clear preference of people in the public sector, i.e. the taxpayer has paid for the courses. But the interesting thing is that Common Purpose does not declare who has been trained, and if people are asking their local council for this information, they're being refused it. So again, I come back to the fact that we have a charity that's allowed to use public money to train people, but the public isn't even allowed to know who's been trained by the charity.
So give us an idea then of what sorts of organisations might one expect to come across a common purpose graduates working, however it may be clandestinely, working in that organisation?
Your local council, particularly a city council, and it can be in a variety of positions within the council, so it could be within development, or it could be accounts, or it could be in the legal section. Indeed, legal section is very popular. And then aside from that, police, hospitals, schools, universities, all of those sorts of areas. And coupled around that, you will find big accountancy firms, banks. HM Prison Service is heavily populated with it, and indeed many of the media, including the BBC.
So have you any idea what the ultimate goal of this organisation is?
Well, we know this because Common Purpose declares it, if you know where to look, and also you can see it happening. Common Purpose says it is training the future leaders, and those future leaders are going to be Common Purpose leaders. And Common Purpose also declares that it's now building networks, which will soon be very important. And what they mean is that the networked leaders will be the leaders to run the new society that they are creating, which in my view is a post-democratic society.
So if I wanted to be one of these new leaders, could I go and get myself on a common purpose course?
You could certainly try, and the first thing you should have is your checkbook, because a substantial course is going to cost you about £5,000. But when you walk in through the office door, you will be vetted from the moment you enter. And so you will be required to submit an application form, and then you have to wait to see whether they consider you acceptable as a trainee. We have a document which shows one gentleman in Ipswich being rejected because Common Purpose believes he's too Ipswich. Now, this is a very interesting statement because the man is a well-respected local businessman running quite a large commercial company. But by too Ipswich, we think that they're implying that this man is with great respect to the gentleman concerned, perhaps a little bit of a country bumpkin.
Okay, so where can people find out more about the current state of affairs with your research on this organisation?
Well, the first thing is from the AV2 conference. There will shortly be some videos on the internet, but we have a website which is www.cpexposed.com, and that is a website where we have started to list factual documentary evidence. So you can go to the website and you can search to find how much police forces have spent, or national health, or schools. So what we've tried to do is get the evidence in front of the public as to what Common Purpose is doing, and so the real documents are there for you to trawl through and look at yourself.
If you suspect, or even if you know, that you're working with someone who is a Common Purpose graduate, is it really right that you should be suspicious of that person, that you're one of a colleague maybe who's working next to you in the office? That seems almost like a kind of paranoia.
There's no reason to be suspicious, but what we are uncovering is a group of people who are running a network which is progressing an agenda which is out of sight of the public. And we are also seeing, and I have to say the evidence for this is just overwhelming, that Common Purpose trained people are prepared in many cases to lie and deceive and falsify documents in order to hide what they have been doing or what other Common Purpose colleagues have been doing. Against that background, to find that you're working with a Common Purpose person who hasn't declared this should at least arouse interest in you. However, what I would add is that we are also confident that what we are watching Common Purpose do is train people by using reframing techniques. So they are using mind manipulation, in this case neuro-linguistic programming, in order to change people's values and ambitions. And this would also give the average person cause for concern. However, since most of the Common Purpose people have no idea of the type of training they've been subjected to, they are in fact victims, overwhelmingly victims, and therefore they certainly shouldn't be regarded with hostility, particularly within the workplace. But I believe that the average person or the average member of the public has a right to know which of their colleagues has been trained by Common Purpose.
So have you had any success at all with Freedom of Information requests?
We've had tremendous success, and if you look at the hundreds of documents on the website I've just given, there are many responses to Freedom of Information requests. And I would also encourage listeners to go to the website whatdotheyknow.com, which now also has hundreds of Freedom of Information responses, which have been obtained by other members of the public who are now paying attention to what we're revealing.
Now, if Common Purpose does have some sort of clandestine agenda, surely it's had it now because you've exposed it.
Well, I'm delighted to say I think we're rapidly approaching that position, because if we go back 5 years ago, although I was very active in my city, Plymouth, I was a businessman, I was involved with the Chamber of Commerce, and I had never heard of Common Purpose or heard people talking about it, including my Chamber of Commerce colleagues. Now, across the country, thousands of people are not only aware of Common Purpose, they are now also asking the same questions. What allows this charity to suck huge amounts of public money in order to train selected elitist people in a political agenda?
What about for people who don't have the internet and can't just hop onto your website?
In that case, they would do well to start reading a paper that we produce, which is called the UK Column. This has been produced as a result of the problems that we had in Plymouth, where we found that once we had obtained truth about fraud, corruption, bullying, misappropriation of public funds, and in many cases the connections with Common Purpose, we could not get that information published. So we started our own newspaper, which is called the UK Column. And if you go to the website, which is www.ukcolumn.org, you will be able to not only read what is actually happening in many of the cities and the UK as a whole, but you will find information in the back copies about Common Purpose, and indeed we'll be doing future articles.
That was Brian Gerrish, former naval officer, talking about his concerns around the charity Common Purpose selecting leaders for tomorrow. And you'll find much more about Brian Gerrish and about the charity Common Purpose online. That was Dialect for this week. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for listening. Do join us next week.
Fly in full effect, yeah.